behind him carrying brown paper parcels. But they vowed, in silence as they walked, to stand by each other and carry out the great compact, to resist tyranny to the death. So there they would sit, one at one end of the boat, one at the other, in silence. They would say nothing, only look at him now and then, where he sat with his legs twisted, frowning and fidgeting, and pishing and shoring and muttering things to himself, and waiting impatiently for a breeze. And they hoped it would be calm. They hoped he would be thwarted. They hoped the whole expedition would fail, and they would have to put back, with their parcels, to the beach. But now, when McAllister's boy had rowed a little way out, the sails slowly swung round, the boat quickened itself, flattened itself, and shot off. Instantly, as if some great strain had been relieved, Mr. Ramsay uncurled his legs, took out his tobacco pouch, handed it with a little grunt to McAllister, and felt, they knew, for all they suffered, perfectly content. Now they would sail on for hours like this, and Mr. Ramsay would ask old McAllister a question, about the great storm last winter, probably, and old McAllister would answer it, and they would puff their pipes together, and McAllister would take a tarry rope in his fingers, tying or untying some knot, and the boy would fish and never say a word to anyone. James would be forced to keep his eye all the time on the sail, for if he forgot, then the sail puckered and shivered, and the boat slackened, and Mr. Ramsay would say sharply, "Look out! Look out!" And old McAllister would turn slowly on his seat. So they heard Mr. Ramsay asking some question about the great storm at Christmas. "She comes driving round the point," old McAllister said, describing the great storm last Christmas, when 10 ships had been driven into the bay for shelter, and he had seen one there, one there, one there. He pointed slowly round the bay. Mr. Ramsay followed him, turning his head. He had seen 4 men clinging to the mast. Then she was gone. "And at last we shoved her off," he went on. But in their anger and their silence, they only caught a word here and there, sitting at opposite ends of the boat, united by their compact to fight tyranny to the death. At last they had shoved her off, they had launched the lifeboat, and they had got her out past the point. McAllister told the story, and though they only caught a word here and there, they were conscious all the time of their father, how he leant forward, how he brought his voice into tune with McAllister's voice, how, puffing at his pipe, and looking there and there where McAllister pointed, he relished the thought of the storm, and the dark night, and the fishermen striving there. He liked that men should labour and sweat on the windy beach at night, pitting muscle and brain against the waves and the wind. He liked men to work like that, and women to keep house, and sit beside sleeping children indoors, while men were drowned, out there in a storm. So James could tell, so Cam could tell. They looked at him, they looked at each other. From his toss and his vigilance and the ring in his voice, and the little tinge of Scottish accent which came into his voice, making him seem like a peasant himself, as he questioned McAllister about the 11 ships that had been driven into the bay in a storm. 3 had sunk. He looked proudly where McAllister pointed, and Cam thought, feeling proud of him, without knowing quite why. Had he been there, he would have launched the lifeboat. He would have reached the wreck, Cam thought. He was so brave, he was so adventurous, Cam thought. But she remembered. There was the compact, to resist tyranny to the death. Their grievance weighed them down. They had been forced. They had been bidden. He had borne them down once more with his gloom and his authority, making them do his bidding, on this fine morning, come, because he wished it, carrying these parcels to the lighthouse. Take part in these rites he went through for his own pleasure in memory of dead people, which they hated, so that they lagged after him. All the pleasure of the day was spoilt. Yes, the breeze was freshening. The boat was leaning. The water was sliced sharply and fell away in green cascades, in bubbles, in cataracts. Cam looked down into the foam, into the sea with all its treasure in it, and its speed hypnotized her, and the tie between her and James sagged a little. It slackened a little. She began to think, how fast it goes. Where are we going? And the movement hypnotized her. While James, with his eye fixed on the sail and on the horizon, steered grimly. But he began to think, as he steered, that he might escape. He might be quit of it all. They might land somewhere and be free then. Both of them, looking at each other for a moment, had a sense of escape and exultation, what with the speed and the change. But the breeze bred in Mr. Ramsay too the same excitement, and, as old McAllister turned to fling his line overboard, he cried out aloud, "We perished!" And then again, "Each alone!" And then, with his usual spasm of repentance or shyness, pulled himself up and waved his hand towards the shore. "See the little house," he said, pointing, wishing Cam to look. She raised herself reluctantly and looked. But which was it? She could no longer make out. There on the hillside, which was their house? All looked distant and peaceful and strange. The shore seemed refined, far away, unreal. Already the little distance they had sailed had put them far from it, and given it the changed look, the composed look, of something receding in which one has no longer any part. Which was their house? She could not see it. "But I beneath a rougher sea," Mr. Ramsay murmured. He had found the house, and so seeing it, he had also seen himself there. He had seen himself walking on the terrace alone. He was walking up and down between the urns, and he seemed to himself very old and bowed. Sitting in the boat, he bowed, he crouched himself, acting instantly his part, the part of a desolate man, widowed, bereft, and so called up before him in hosts people sympathizing with him, staged for himself as he sat in the boat, a little drama, which required of him decrepitude and exhaustion and sorrow. He raised his hands and looked at the thinness of them to confirm his dream. And then there was given him in abundance women's sympathy, and he imagined how they would soothe him and sympathize with him, and so getting in his dream some reflection of the exquisite pleasure women's sympathy was to him, he sighed and said gently and mournfully, "But I, beneath the rougher sea, was whelmed in deeper gulfs than he." So that the mournful words were heard quite clearly by them all. Cam half started on her seat. It shocked her. It outraged her. The movement roused her father, and he shuddered and broke off, exclaiming, "Look, look!" So urgently that James also turned his head to look over his shoulder at the island. They all looked. They looked at the island. But Cam could see nothing. She was thinking how all those paths and the lawn, thick and knotted with the lives they had lived there, were gone, were rubbed out, were past, were unreal, and now this was real. The boat and the sail with its patch, McAllister with his earrings, the noise of the waves, all this was real. Thinking this, she was murmuring to herself, "We perished, each alone." For her father's words broke and broke again in her mind, when her father, seeing her gazing so vaguely, began to tease her. "Didn't she know the points of the compass?" he asked. "Didn't she know the north from the south? Did she really think they lived right out there?" And he pointed again, and showed her where their house was, there, by those trees. He wished she would try to be more accurate. He said, "Tell me, which is east, which is west?" he said, half laughing at her, half scolding her, for he could not understand the state of mind of anyone, not absolutely imbecile, who did not know the points of the compass. Yet she did not know. and seeing her gazing, with her vague, now rather frightened eyes, fixed where no house was, Mr. Ramsay forgot his dream, how he walked up and down between the urns on the terrace, how the arms were stretched out to him. He thought, women are always like that. The vagueness of their minds is hopeless. It was a thing he had never been able to understand, but so it was. It had been so with her, his wife. They could not keep anything clearly fixed in their minds. But he had been wrong to be angry with her. Moreover, did he not rather like this vagueness in women? It was part of their extraordinary charm. "I will make her smile at me," he thought. "She looks frightened." She was so silent. He clutched his fingers and determined that his voice and his face and all the quick, expressive gestures which had been at his command, making people pity him and praise him all these years, should subdue themselves. He would make her smile at him. He would find some simple, easy thing to say to her. But what? For, wrapped up in his work as he was, he forgot the sort of thing one said. There was a puppy. They had a puppy. "Who was looking after the puppy today?" he asked. "Yes," thought James pitilessly, seeing his sister's head against the sail. "Now she will give way. I shall be left to fight the tyrant alone. The compact would be left to him to carry out. Cam would never resist tyranny to the death," he thought grimly, watching her face, sad, sulky, yielding. And, as sometimes happens when a cloud falls on a green hillside, and gravity descends, and there among all the surrounding hills is gloom and sorrow, and it seems as if the hills themselves must ponder the fate of the clouded, the darkened, either in pity or maliciously rejoicing in her dismay. So Cam now felt herself overcast, as she sat there among calm, resolute people, and wondered how to answer her father about the puppy, how to resist his entreaty, "Forgive me, care for me," while James the lawgiver, with the tablets of eternal wisdom laid open on his knee, his hand on the tiller had become symbolical to her, said, "Resist him, fight him." He said so rightly, justly, for they must fight tyranny to the death, she thought. Of all human qualities she reverenced justice most. Her brother was most godlike, her father most suppliant. And to which did she yield, she thought, sitting between them, gazing at the shore whose points were all unknown to her, and thinking how the lawn and the terrace and the house were smoothed away now, and peace dwelt there. "Jasper," she said sullenly, "he'd look after the puppy." "And what was she going to call him?" her father persisted. "He had had a dog when he was a little boy, called Frisk." "She'll give way," James thought, as he watched a look come upon her face, a look he remembered. They look down, he thought, at their knitting or something. Then suddenly they look up. There was a flash of blue, he remembered, and then somebody sitting with him laughed, surrendered, and he was very angry. It must have been his mother, he thought, sitting on a low chair, with his father standing over her. He began to search among the infinite series of impressions which time had laid down, leaf upon leaf, fold upon fold, softly, incessantly upon his brain, among scents, sounds, voices harsh, hollow, sweet, and lights passing, and brooms tapping, and the wash and hush of the sea, how a man had marched up and down and stopped dead, upright, over them. Meanwhile, he noticed, Cam dabbled her fingers in the water, and stared at the shore and said nothing. "No, she won't give way," he thought. "She's different," he thought. Well, if Cam would not answer him, he would not bother her, Mr. Ramsay decided, feeling in his pocket for a book. But she would answer him. She wished passionately to move some obstacle that lay upon her tongue, and to say, "Oh yes, Frisk, I'll call him Frisk." She wanted even to say, "Was that the dog that found its way over the moor alone?" But try as she might, she could think of nothing to say like that. Fierce and loyal to the compact, yet passing on to her father, unsuspected by James, a private token of the love she felt for him. For, she thought, dabbling her hand, and now McAllister's boy had caught a mackerel, and it lay kicking on the floor with blood on its gills. For she thought, looking at James, who kept his eyes dispassionately on the sail, or glanced now and then for a second at the horizon, you're not exposed to it, to this pressure and division of feeling, this extraordinary temptation. Her father was feeling in his pockets. In another second he would have found his book. For no one attracted her more. His hands were beautiful, and his feet, and his voice, and his words, and his haste, and his temper, and his oddity, and his passion, and his saying straight out before everyone, "We perish, each alone," and his remoteness. He had opened his book. But what remained intolerable, she thought, sitting upright, and watching McAllister's boy tug the hook out of the gills of another fish, was that crass blindness and tyranny of his which had poisoned her childhood and raised bitter storms, so that even now she woke in the night trembling with rage, and remembered some command of his, some insolence. Do this, do that. His dominance, his submit to me. So she said nothing, but looked doggedly and sadly at the shore, wrapped in its mantle of peace, as if the people there had fallen asleep, she thought, were free like smoke, were free to come and go like ghosts. They have no suffering there, she thought.
End of section 13. Section 14 of To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf.
Chapter 6. Yes, that is their boat, Lily Briscoe decided, standing on the edge of the lawn. It was the boat with greyish-brown sails, which she saw now flatten itself upon the water and shoot off across the bay. There he sits, she thought, and the children are quite silent still. And she could not reach him either. The sympathy she had not given him weighed her down. It made it difficult for her to paint. She had always found him difficult. She had never been able to praise him to his face, she remembered, and that reduced their relationship to something neutral, without that element of sex in it which made his manner to Minta so gallant, almost gay. He would pick a flower for her, lend her his books. But could he believe that Minta read them? She dragged them about the garden, sticking in leaves to mark the place. "Do you remember, Mr. Carmichael?" she was inclined to ask, looking at the old man. But he had pulled his hat half over his forehead. He was asleep, or he was dreaming, or he was lying there catching words, she supposed. "Do you remember?" she felt inclined to ask him as she passed him, thinking again of Mrs. Ramsay on the beach, the cask bobbing up and down, and the pages flying. Why, after all these years, had that survived, ringed round, lit up, visible to the last detail, with all before it blank, and all after it blank, for miles and miles? "Is it a boat? Is it a cork?" she would say, Lily repeated, turning back, reluctantly again, to her canvas. Heaven be praised for it, the problem of space remained, she thought, taking up her brush again. It glared at her. The whole mass of the picture was poised upon that weight. Beautiful and bright it should be on the surface, feathery and evanescent, one colour melting into another like the colours on a butterfly's wing, but beneath the fabric must be clamped together with bolts of iron. It was to be a thing you could ruffle with your breath, and a thing you could not dislodge with a team of horses. And she began to lay on a red, a grey, and she began to model her way into the hollow there. At the same time, she seemed to be sitting beside Mrs. Ramsay on the beach. "Is it a boat? Is it a cask?" Mrs. Ramsay said, and she began hunting round for her spectacles. And she sat, having found them, silent, looking out to sea. And Lily, painting steadily, felt as if a door had opened, and one went in and stood gazing silently about in a high, cathedral-like place, very dark, very solemn. Shouts came from a world far away. Steamers vanished in stalks of smoke on the horizon. Charles threw stones and sent them skipping. Mrs. Ramsay sat silent. She was glad, Lily thought, to rest in silence, uncommunicative, to rest in the extreme obscurity of human relationships. Who knows what we are, what we feel? Who knows, even at the moment of intimacy, this is knowledge? Aren't things spoilt, then? Mrs. Ramsay may have asked. It seemed to have happened so often, this silence by her side, by saying them. Aren't we more expressive thus? The moment at least seemed extraordinarily fertile. She rammed a little hole in the sand and covered it up, by way of burying in it the perfection of the moment. It was like a drop of silver in which one dipped and illumined the darkness of the past. Lily stepped back to get her canvas, so, into perspective. It was an odd road to be walking, this of painting. Out and out one went, further, until at last one seemed to be on a narrow plank, perfectly alone over the sea. And, as she dipped into the blue paint, she dipped too into the past there. Now Mrs. Ramsay got up, she remembered. It was time to go back to the house, time for luncheon. And they all walked up from the beach together, she walking behind with William Banks, and there was Minta in front of them with a hole in her stocking. How that little round hole of pink heel seemed to flaunt itself before them. How William Banks deplored it, without, so far as she could remember, saying anything about it. It meant to him the annihilation of womanhood, and dirt and disorder, and servants leaving and beds not made at midday, all the things he most abhorred. He had a way of shuddering and spreading his fingers out, as if to cover an unsightly object, which he did now, holding his hand in front of him. And Minta walked on ahead, and presumably Paul met her, and she went off with Paul in the garden. The Raleys, thought Lily Briscoe, squeezing her tube of green paint. She collected her impressions of the Raleys. Their lives appeared to her in a series of scenes, one on the staircase at dawn. Paul had come in and gone to bed early. Minta was late. There was Minta, wreathed, tinted, garish on the stairs about 3 o'clock in the morning. Paul came out in his pyjamas carrying a poker in case of burglars. Minta was eating a sandwich, standing halfway up by a window, in the cadaverous early morning light, and the carpet had a hole in it. But what did they say? Lily asked herself, as if by looking she could hear them. Minta went on eating her sandwich, annoyingly, while he spoke something violent, abusing her, in a mutter, so as not to wake the children, the two little boys. He was withered, drawn, she flamboyant, careless. For things had worked loose after the first year or so, the marriage had turned out rather badly. And this, Lily thought, taking the green paint on her brush, this making up scenes about them, is what we call knowing people, thinking of them, being fond of them. Not a word of it was true, she had made it up, but it was what she knew them by all the same. She went on tunnelling her way into her picture, into the past. Another time, Paul said he played chess in coffee houses. She had built up a whole structure of imagination on that saying, too. She remembered how, as he said it, she thought how he rang up the servant, and she said, "Mrs. Raleigh's out, sir," and he decided that he would not come home either. She saw him sitting in the corner of some lugubrious place, where the smoke attached itself to the red plush seats, and the waitresses got to know you, and he played chess with a little man who was in the tea trade and lived at Surbiton, but that was all Paul knew about him. And then Minta was out when he came home, and then there was that scene on the stairs, when he got the poker in case of burglars, no doubt to frighten her too, and spoke so bitterly, saying she had ruined his life. At any rate, when she went down to see them at a cottage near Rickmansworth, things were horribly strained. Paul took her down the garden to look at the Belgian hares which he bred, and Minta followed them, singing, and put her bare arm on his shoulder, lest he should tell her anything. Minta was bored by hares, Lily thought. But Minta never gave herself away. She never said things like that about playing chess in coffee shops. She was far too conscious, far too wary. But to go on with their story. They had got through the dangerous stage by now. She had been staying with them last summer sometime, and the car broke down, and Minta had to hand him his tools. He sat on the road mending the car, and it was the way she gave him the tools, businesslike, straightforward, friendly, that proved it was all right now. They were in love no longer. No, he had taken up with another woman, a serious woman, with her hair in a plait and a case in her hand. Minta had described her gratefully, almost admiringly. Who went to meetings and shared Paul's views? They had got more and more pronounced. About the taxation of land values and a capital levy. Far from breaking up the marriage, that alliance had righted it. They were excellent friends, obviously, as he sat on the road and she handed him his tools. So that was the story of the Raileys, Lily thought. She imagined herself telling it to Mrs. Ramsay, who would be full of curiosity to know what had become of the Raileys. She would feel a little triumphant, telling Mrs. Ramsay that the marriage had not been a success. But the dead, thought Lily, encountering some obstacle in her design which made her pause and ponder, stepping back a foot or so. "Oh, the dead," she murmured. "One pitied them. One brushed them aside. One had even a little contempt for them. They are at our mercy. Mrs. Ramsay has faded and gone," she thought. "We can override her wishes, improve away her limited, old-fashioned ideas. She recedes further and further from us." Mockingly, she seemed to see her there at the end of the corridor of years, saying, of all incongruous things, "Marry, marry!" Sitting very upright early in the morning with the birds beginning to cheep in the garden outside. And one would have to say to her, "It has all gone against your wishes. They're happy like that. I'm happy like this. Life has changed completely." At that, all her being, even her beauty, became for a moment dusty and out of date. For a moment Lily, standing there, with the sun hot on her back, summing up the Raileys, triumphed over Mrs. Ramsay, who would never know how Paul went to coffee-houses and had a mistress, how he sat on the ground and Minta handed him his tools, how she stood here painting, had never married, not even William Banks. Mrs. Ramsay had planned it. Perhaps, had she lived, she would have compelled it. Already that summer he was the kindest of men. He was the first scientist of his age, my husband says. He was also, "Poor William, it makes me so unhappy when I go to see him, to find nothing nice in his house, no one to arrange the flowers." So they were sent for walks together, and she was told, with that faint touch of irony that made Mrs. Ramsay slip through one's fingers, that she had a scientific mind, she liked flowers, she was so exact. What was this mania of hers for marriage? Lily wondered, stepping to and fro from her easel. Suddenly as a star slides in the sky, a reddish light seemed to burn in her mind, covering Paul Raileys, issuing from him. It rose like a fire sent up in token of some celebration by savages on a distant beach. She heard the roar and the crackle. The whole sea for miles round ran red and gold. Some winey smell mixed with it and intoxicated her, for she felt again her own headlong desire to throw herself off the cliff and be drowned looking for a pearl brooch on a beach. And the roar and the crackle repelled her with fear and disgust, as if while she saw its splendour and power, She saw, too, how it fed on the treasure of the house, greedily, disgustingly, and she loathed it. But for a sight, for a glory, it surpassed everything in her experience, and burnt year after year like a signal fire on a desert island at the edge of the sea, and one had only to say, "In love," and instantly, as happened now, uprose Paul's fire again. And it sank, and she said to herself, laughing, "The Raleys!" How Paul went to coffee-houses and played chess. She had only escaped by the skin of her teeth, though, she thought. She had been looking at the tablecloth, and it had flashed upon her that she would move the tree to the middle, and need never marry anybody, and she had felt an enormous exultation. She had felt, now she could stand up to Mrs. Ramsay, a tribute to the astonishing power that Mrs. Ramsay had over one. "Do this," she said, and one did it. Even her shadow at the window with James was full of authority. She remembered how William Banks had been shocked by her neglect of the significance of mother and son. "Did she not admire their beauty?" he said. But William, she remembered, had listened to her with his wise child's eyes when she explained how it was not irreverence, how a light there needed a shadow there, and so on. She did not intend to disparage a subject which, they agreed, Raphael had treated divinely. She was not cynical. Quite the contrary. Thanks to his scientific mind, he understood, a proof of disinterested intelligence which had pleased her and comforted her enormously. One could talk of painting, then, seriously to a man. Indeed, his friendship had been one of the pleasures of her life. She loved William Banks. They went to Hampton Court, and he always left her, like the perfect gentleman he was, plenty of time to wash her hands while he strolled by the river. That was typical of their relationship. Many things were left unsaid. Then they strolled through the courtyards and admired, summer after summer, the proportions and the flowers, and he would tell her things about perspective, about architecture, as they walked. And he would stop to look at a tree, or the view over the lake, and admire a child. It was his great grief, he had no daughter. In the vague, aloof way that was natural to a man who spent so much time in laboratories, that the world, when he came out, seemed to dazzle him, so that he walked slowly, lifted his hand to screen his eyes, and paused, with his head thrown back, merely to breathe the air. Then he would tell her how his housekeeper was on her holiday. He must buy a new carpet for the staircase. Perhaps she would go with him to buy a new carpet for the staircase. And once something led him to talk about the Ramsays, and he had said how when he first saw her she had been wearing a grey hat. She was not more than 19 or 20. She was astonishingly beautiful. There he stood, looking down the avenue at Hampton Court, as if he could see her there among the fountains. She looked now at the drawing-room step. She saw, through William's eyes, the shape of a woman, peaceful and silent, with downcast eyes. She sat musing, pondering. She was in grey that day, Lily thought. Her eyes were bent. She would never lift them. "Yes," thought Lily, looking intently, "I must have seen her look like that. But not in grey, nor so still, nor so young, nor so peaceful." The figure came readily enough. She was astonishingly beautiful, as William said. But beauty was not everything. Beauty had this penalty. It came too readily, came too completely. It stilled life, froze it. One forgot the little agitations, the flush, the pallor, some queer distortion, some light or shadow, which made the face unrecognisable for a moment, and yet added a quality one saw for ever after. It was simpler to smooth that all out under the cover of beauty. But what was the look she had, Lily wondered, when she clapped her deerstalker's hat on her head, or ran across the grass, or scolded Kennedy the gardener? Who could tell her? Who could help her? Against her will she had come to the surface, and found herself half out of the picture, looking, little dazedly, as if at unreal things, at Mr. Carmichael. He lay on his chair with his hands clasped above his paunch, not reading or sleeping, but basking like a creature gorged with existence. His book had fallen onto the grass. She wanted to go straight up to him and say, "Mr. Carmichael." Then he would look up benevolently, as always, from his smoky, vague green eyes. But one only woke people if one knew what one wanted to say to them. And she wanted to say not one thing, but everything. Little words that broke up the thought and dismembered it said nothing. About life, about death, about Mrs. Ramsay. No, she thought, one could say nothing to nobody. The urgency of the moment always missed its mark. Words fluttered sideways and struck the object inches too low. Then one gave it up, then the idea sunk back again. Then one became like most middle-aged people, cautious, furtive, with wrinkles between the eyes and a look of perpetual apprehension. For how could one express in words these emotions of the body, express that emptiness there? She was looking at the drawing-room steps. They looked extraordinarily empty. It was one's body feeling, not one's mind. The physical sensations that went with the bare look of the steps had become suddenly extremely unpleasant. To want and not to have sent all up her body a hardness, a hollowness, a strain. And then to want and not to have, to want and want, how that wrung the heart, and wrung it again and again. "Oh, Mrs. Ramsay," she called out silently, to that essence which sat by the boat, that abstract one made of her, that woman in grey, as if to abuse her for having gone, and then having gone, come back again. It had seemed so safe, thinking of her. Ghost, air, nothingness, a thing you could play with easily and safely at any time of day or night. She had been that, and then suddenly she put her hand out and wrung the heart thus. Suddenly the empty drawing-room steps, the frill of the chair inside, the puppy tumbling on the terrace, the whole wave and whisper of the garden, became like curves and arabesques flourishing round a centre of complete emptiness. "What does it mean? How do you explain it all?" she wanted to say, turning to Mr. Carmichael again. For the whole world seemed to have dissolved in this early morning hour into a pool of thought, a deep basin of reality, and one could almost fancy that had Mr. Carmichael spoken, for instance, a little tear would have rent the surface pool. And then? Something would emerge. A hand would be shoved up, a blade would be flashed. It was nonsense, of course. A curious notion came to her that he did, after all, hear the things she could not say. He was an inscrutable old man, with the yellow stain on his beard, and his poetry and his puzzles, sailing serenely through a world which satisfied all his wants, so that she thought he only had to put down his hand where he lay on the lawn to fish up anything he wanted. She looked at her picture. That would have been his answer, presumably. How you and I and she pass and vanish. Nothing stays. All changes. But not words. Not paint. Yet it would be hung in the attics, she thought. It would be rolled up and flung under a sofa. Yet even so, even of a picture like that, it was true. One might say, even of this scrawl, not of that actual picture, perhaps, but of what it attempted, that it remained for ever, she was going to say. Or, for the words spoken sounded even to herself too boastful, to hint wordlessly. When, looking at the picture, she was surprised to find that she could not see it. Her eyes were full of a hot liquid, she did not think of tears at first, which, without disturbing the firmness of her lips, made the air thick, rolled down her cheeks. She had perfect control of herself. Oh, yes, in every other way. Was she crying, then, for Mrs. Ramsay, without being aware of any unhappiness? she addressed old Mr. Carmichael again. What was it, then? What did it mean? Could things thrust their hands up and grip one? Could the blade cut, the fist grasp? Was there no safety, no learning by heart of the ways of the world? No guide, no shelter, but all was miracle and leaping from the pinnacle of a tower into the air. Could it be, even for elderly people, that this was life, startling, unexpected, unknown? For one moment she felt that if they both got up, here, now, on the lawn, and demanded an explanation, why was it so short, why was it so inexplicable, said it with violence, as two fully equipped human beings from which nothing should be hid might speak, then beauty would roll itself up, the space would fill, those empty flourishes would form into shape. If they shouted loud enough, Mrs. Ramsay would return. "Mrs. Ramsay," she said aloud. "Mrs. Ramsay!" The tears ran down her face. Chapter 7 McAllister's boy took one of the fish and cut a square out of its side to bait his hook with. The mutilated body, it was alive still, was thrown back into the sea. End of section 14. Section 15 of To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. Chapter 8. "Mrs. Ramsay!" Lily cried. "Mrs. Ramsay!" But nothing happened. The pain increased. That anguish could reduce one to such a pitch of imbecility, she thought. Anyhow, the old man had not heard her. He remained benignant, calm, if one chose to think it, sublime. Heaven be praised, no one had heard her cry that ignominious cry, "Stop, pain, stop!" She had not obviously taken leave of her senses. No one had seen her step off her strip of board into the waters of annihilation. She remained a skimpy old maid, holding a paintbrush. And now, slowly, the pain of the want and the bitter anger, to be called back, just as she thought she would never feel sorrow for Mrs. Ramsay again. Had she missed her among the coffee-cups at breakfast? Not in the least. Lessened, and of their anguish left, as an antidote, a relief that was balm in itself, and also, but more mysteriously, a sense of someone there, of Mrs. Ramsay, relieved for a moment of the weight that the world had put on her, staying lightly by her side, and then, for this was Mrs. Ramsay in all her beauty, raising to her forehead a wreath of white flowers with which she went. Lily squeezed her tubes again. She attacked that problem of the hedge. It was strange how clearly she saw her, stepping with her usual quickness across fields, among whose folds, purplish and soft, among whose flowers, hyacinths or lilies, she vanished. It was some trick of the painter's eye. For days after she had heard of her death, she had seen her thus, putting her wreath to her forehead and going unquestioningly with her companion, a shade across the fields. The sight, the phrase, had its power to console. Wherever she happened to be, painting, here, in the country or in London, the vision would come to her, and her eyes, half-closing, sought something to base her vision on. She looked down the railway carriage, the omnibus, took a line from shoulder or cheek, looked at the windows opposite, at Piccadilly, lamp-strung in the evening. All had been part of the fields of death. But always something, it might be a face, a voice, a paper-boy crying, "Standard news!" thrust through, snubbed her, waked her, required and got in the end an effort of attention, so that the vision must be perpetually remade. Now again, moved as she was by some instinctive need of distance and blue, she looked at the bay beneath her, making hillocks of the blue bars of the waves, and stony fields of the purpler spaces. Again she was roused as usual by something incongruous.
there was a brown spot in the middle of the bay. It was a boat. Yes, she realized that after a second. But whose boat? Mr. Ramsay's boat, she replied. Mr. Ramsay, the man who had marched past her, with his hand raised, aloof, at the head of a procession, in his beautiful boots, asking her for sympathy, which she had refused. The boat was now halfway across the bay. So fine was the morning, except for a streak of wind here and there, that the sea and sky looked all one fabric, as if sails were stuck high up in the sky, or the clouds had dropped down into the sea. A steamer far out at sea had drawn in the air a great scroll of smoke, which stayed there curving and circling decoratively, as if the air were a fine gauze which held things and kept them softly in its mesh, only gently swaying them this way and that. And, as happens sometimes when the weather is very fine, the cliffs looked as if they were conscious of the ships, and the ships looked as if they were conscious of the cliffs, as if they signalled to each other some message of their own. For sometimes, quite close to the shore, the lighthouse looked this morning, in the haze, an enormous distance away. Where are they now? Lily thought, looking out to sea. Where was he, that very old man who had gone past her silently, holding a brown paper parcel under his arm? The boat was in the middle of the bay. Chapter 9. They don't feel a thing there, Cam thought, looking at the shore, which, rising and falling, became steadily more distant and more peaceful. Her hand cut a trail in the sea, as her mind made the green swirls and streaks into patterns, and, numbed and shrouded, wandered in imagination in that underworld of waters where the pearls stuck in clusters to white sprays. A change came over one's entire mind, and one's body shone half-transparent, enveloped in a green cloak. Then the eddy slackened round her hand. The rush of the water ceased. The world became full of little creaking and squeaking sounds. One heard the waves breaking and flapping against the side of the boat as if they were anchored in harbour. Everything became very close to one. For the sail, upon which James had his eyes fixed until it had become to him like a person whom he knew, sagged entirely. There they came to a stop, flapping about waiting for a breeze, in the hot sun, miles from shore, miles from the lighthouse. Everything in the whole world seemed to stand still. The lighthouse became immovable, and the line of the distant shore became fixed. The sun grew hotter, and everybody seemed to come very close together and to feel each other's presence, which they had almost forgotten. McAllister's fishing line went plumb down into the sea, but Mr. Ramsay went on reading with his legs curled under him. He was reading a little shiny book with covers mottled like a plover's egg. Now and again, as they hung about in that horrid calm, he turned a page. And James felt that each page was turned with a peculiar gesture aimed at him, now assertively, now commandingly, now with the intention of making people pity him. And all the time, as his father read and turned one after another of those little pages, James kept dreading the moment when he would look up and speak sharply to him about something or other. "Why were they lagging about here?" he would demand, or something quite unreasonable like that. "And if he does," James thought, "then I shall take a knife and strike him to the heart." He had always kept this old symbol of taking a knife and striking his father to the heart. Only now, as he grew older, and sat staring at his father in an impotent rage, it was not him, that old man reading, whom he wanted to kill, but it was the thing that descended on him, without his knowing it, perhaps. That fierce, sudden, black-winged harpy, with its talons and its beak all cold and hard, that struck and struck at you. He could feel the beak on his bare legs, where it had struck when he was a child, and then made off,
and there he was again, an old man, very sad, reading his book. That he would kill, that he would strike to the heart. Whatever he did, and he might do anything, he felt, looking at the lighthouse and the distant shore, whether he was in a business, in a bank, a barrister, a man at the head of some enterprise, that he would fight, that he would track down and stamp out. Tyranny, despotism, he called it, making people do what they did not want to do, cutting off their right to speak. How could any of them say, "But I won't," when he said, "Come to the lighthouse, do this, fetch me that"? The black wings spread, and the hard beak tore. And then, next moment, there he sat reading his book, and he might look up, one never knew, quite reasonably. He might talk to the McAllisters. He might be pressing a sovereign into some frozen old woman's hand in the street, James thought, and he might be shouting out at some fisherman's sports. He might be waving his arms in the air with excitement. Or he might sit at the head of the table, dead silent, from one end of dinner to the other. Yes, thought James, while the boat slapped and dawdled there in the hot sun. There was a waste of snow and rock, very lonely and austere, and there he had come to feel, quite often lately, when his father said something or did something which surprised the others. There were two pairs of footprints only, his own and his father's. They alone knew each other. What, then, was this terror, this hatred? Turning back among the many leaves which the past had folded in him, peering into the heart of that forest where light and shade so chequer each other, that all shape is distorted, and one blunders, now with the sun in one's eyes, now with a dark shadow, he sought an image to cool and detach and round off his feeling in a concrete shape. Suppose, then, that as a child, sitting helpless in a perambulator, or on someone's knee, he had seen a wagon crush ignorantly and innocently someone's foot. Suppose he had seen the foot first, in the grass, smooth and whole, then the wheel, and the same foot, purple, crushed. But the wheel was innocent. So now, when his father came striding down the passage, knocking them up early in the morning to go to the lighthouse, down it came over his foot, over Cam's foot, over anybody's foot. One sat and watched it. But whose foot was he thinking of, and in what garden did all this happen? For one had settings for these scenes, trees that grew there, flowers, a certain light, a few figures. Everything tended to set itself in a garden where there was none of this gloom, none of this throwing of hands about. People spoke in an ordinary tone of voice. They went in and out all day long. There was an old woman gossiping in the kitchen, and the blinds were sucked in and out by the breeze. All was blowing, all was growing, and over all those plates and bowls and tall brandishing red and yellow flowers, a very thin yellow veil would be drawn, like a vine leaf at night. Things became stiller and darker at night. But the leaf-like veil was so fine that lights lifted it, voices crinkled it. He could see through it a figure stooping, here, coming close, going away, some dress rustling, some chain tinkling. It was in this world that the wheel went over the person's foot. Something, he remembered, stayed flourished up in the air, something arid and sharp descended even there, like a blade, a scimitar, smiting through the leaves and flowers, even of that happy world, and making it shrivel and fall. "It will rain," he remembered his father saying. "You won't be able to go to the lighthouse." The lighthouse was then a silvery, misty-looking tower with a yellow eye that opened suddenly and softly in the evening. Now, James looked at the lighthouse. He could see the whitewashed rocks, the tower, stark and straight. He could see that it was barred with black and white. He could see windows in it. He could even see washing spread on the rocks to dry.
So that was the lighthouse, was it?
No, the other was also the lighthouse. For nothing was simply one thing. The other lighthouse was true, too. It was sometimes hardly to be seen across the bay. In the evening one looked up and saw the eye opening and shutting, and the light seemed to reach them in that airy sunny garden where they sat. But he pulled himself up. Whenever he said "they" or "a person," and then began hearing the rustle of someone coming, the tinkle of someone going, he became extremely sensitive to the presence of whoever might be in the room. It was his father now. The strain was acute. For in one moment, if there was no breeze, his father would slap the covers of his book together and say, "What's happening now? What are we dawdling about for here, eh?" As, once before, he had brought his blade down among them on the terrace, and she had gone stiff all over, and if there had been an axe handy, a knife, or anything with a sharp point, he would have seized it and struck his father through the heart. She had gone stiff all over, and then, her arm slackening, so that he felt she listened to him no longer, she had risen somehow and gone away and left him there, impotent, ridiculous, sitting on the floor grasping a pair of scissors. Not a breath of wind blew. The water chuckled and gurgled in the bottom of the boat, where three or four mackerel beat their tails up and down in a pool of water not deep enough to cover them. At any moment Mr. Ramsay, he scarcely dared to look at him, might rouse himself, shut his book and say something sharp. But for the moment he was reading, so that James stealthily, as if he were stealing downstairs on bare feet, afraid of waking a watchdog by a creaking board, went on thinking what was she like, where did she go that day? He began following her from room to room, and at last they came to a room where, in a blue light, as if the reflection came from many china dishes, she talked to somebody. He listened to her talking. She talked to a servant, saying simply whatever came into her head. She alone spoke the truth. To her alone could he speak it. That was the source of her everlasting attraction for him, perhaps. She was a person to whom one could say what came into one's head. But all the time he thought of her, he was conscious of his father following his thought, surveying it, making it shiver and falter. At last he ceased to think. There he sat, with his hand on the tiller in the sun, staring at the lighthouse, powerless to move, powerless to flick off these grains of misery which settled on his mind one after another. A rope seemed to bind him there, and his father had knotted it, and he could only escape by taking a knife and plunging it. But at that moment the sail swung slowly round, filled slowly out, the boat seemed to shake herself, and then to move off, half-conscious in her sleep, and then she woke and shot through the waves. The relief was extraordinary. They all seemed to fall away from each other again, and to be at their ease, and the fishing lines slanted taut across the side of the boat. But his father did not rouse himself. He only raised his right hand mysteriously high in the air, and let it fall upon his knee again, as if he were conducting some secret symphony. Chapter 10 The sea without a stain on it, thought Lily Briscoe, still standing and looking out over the bay. The sea stretched like silk across the bay. Distance had an extraordinary power. They had been swallowed up in it, she felt. They were gone for ever. They had become part of the nature of things. It was so calm. It was so quiet. The steamer itself had vanished, but the great scroll of smoke still hung in the air and drooped like a flag mournfully in valediction. Chapter 11 It was like that, then, the island, thought Cam, once more drawing her fingers through the waves. She had never seen it from out at sea before. It lay like that on the sea, did it, with a dent in the middle and two sharp crags, and the sea swept in there,